Good morning, everyone. So we have a few things going on today. One is that we are going to start experimenting with doing the announcements at the end. So we'll be kind of transitioning into that, actually starting in July. But today we wanted to start it that way today because we have a short ceremony after the talk, and I'll talk a little bit about that during the talk, what that's about. And also, today is the opening of our spring appeal, so we'll have a special longer announcement at the end about that as well from our board chair. But what I would like to talk about for the main part of the talk is something from the flower ornament scripture, which I think some of you know I'm taking up the task of studying this year. This is half of it. So this one has larger print. I have one at home that is about the size, but it's the whole thing with smaller print. But there's so much wonderful teachings in there that I'm actually happy to be taking it up as a project. So I just have a little something I'd like to share, and it's from a chapter that's called The 10 Inexhaustible Treasuries. And these are the treasuries that bodhisattvas, or great enlightening beings, have. So what are great enlightening beings? You hear a lot about bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, which are the great enlightening beings. These are beings who sometimes, so enlightening beings rather than enlightened beings, the emphasis is on helping others. So on helping other beings, on enlightening or helping other beings to wake up. Or just, we could say, liberating other beings or freeing beings from suffering. And I shouldn't actually even say other beings, I should just say beings, because when bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, free beings from suffering, they include themselves in who is freed from suffering and who is liberated and who is awakened. And in the Mahayana teaching, which Soto Zen Buddhism is part of the Mahayana teaching, we are also not separate from bodhisattvas, mahasattvas. So it's not like there's these other great enlightening beings that are out there somewhere, and then we're the lowly ones that are here. We also are, sometimes you say baby bodhisattvas. You know, we're on the path of bodhisattvahood. So there's kind of two ways, when I'm reading about these and all the treasuries and all the wonderful deeds and the wonderful things that these bodhisattvas do, sometimes I think to myself, well, I'm not there yet. And that's okay if I think that way, as long as for me it's like wholesome to think that if at the same time I see like this is a possibility. And this is something I can be feel inspired by and also feel nurtured by or protected by somehow. So that's one way of receiving it. But the other way is like, and I will do these things. And I have these treasuries already that the great enlightening beings have because I'm not separate from them. So in this sutra, it says that great enlightening beings have 10 kinds of treasuries. I won't have time to talk about all 10, but I'll just tell you what they are. The treasury of faith, the treasury of ethics, the treasury of shame, the treasury of conscience, treasury of learning, the treasury of giving, the treasury of wisdom, the treasury of recollection, the treasury of preservation, and the treasury of elocution. I mean, in some ways, I do want to talk about all 10, but but I can't and do them justice. So I would just mention first, because I know that recently there have been a few talks on faith. So I don't want to talk a lot about faith, but I just do want to say that's the first treasury, and I think it's listed first for a reason. Faith here means opening to emptiness, opening to non-discrimination. It means believing all things have no basis. All things cannot be measured. All things are uncreated. So really, the first treasury provides this foundation of groundlessness for all the other treasuries. So it provides a foundation of such boundless openness for all the other treasuries. So that, to me, seems important to keep in mind. What I would like to focus on today is especially the treasury of ethics, and also I'll say a little bit about the treasury of shame, since that might seem surprising as a treasury, and the treasury of conscience. So now would be a time we could pass out. So we have a brochure called the Ethical Guidelines and Grievance Procedure brochure. On the back is the 16 Bodhisattva precepts, and Susan will pass out some copies. And actually, I have some extra here. It looks like we might need them. There might not be enough for everyone. And at the end, if you want to keep the brochure, please keep it, because we can make more copies. But if you don't want to keep it, then just set it on the greeter table. So I'd like to start with just mentioning the 16 Bodhisattva precepts, which are right on the back. And I'll talk more about the Ethics and Reconciliation Committee and procedure in a bit. So in our tradition, we have the beginning of the precepts, and precepts are guidelines for ethical living. We have the three refuges. So as a precept, we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Like, that's the initial beginning. And then we have the three collective pure precepts, which are doing no harm, doing good, and freeing all beings. So like, those cover everything, right? But then, because we sometimes need to be a little more specific, we have the 10 grave precepts, which are more specific. So the 10 grave precepts, and I won't read it through all the way, but just maybe I'll just for the first one, I'll say there's a sort of a preamble. So the first one is non-killing. We don't usually just say that. We say, recognizing that I'm not separate from all that is, I take up the way of non-killing. So there's a way in which we do these precepts from a certain stance, and that is important. So that is a way that we can do them that isn't rigid and isn't just like following a rule. It's really opening our hearts to see, why would we want to do this? Well, if I'm not separate from all that is, then naturally I don't want to kill. So there's non-killing, non-stealing, not misusing sexuality, not speaking falsely, not being deluded, and not giving or taking intoxicants. And some people, just for the new people, I want to say, get really tripped up on this and say, oh, well, I could never do Jukai, I could never formally take the precepts because I like to have a glass of wine with dinner every once in a while, or whatever like that. So just to say that the not being deluded is the first thing there. And that with all of these precepts, we enter into what is the way in which I can go forward toward doing these precepts and honoring, like in this case, cultivating a mind that sees clearly. What would be the way I could do that? And to see it as a process. And to decide for yourself how you keep the precept in communication with others, so you're not just completely on your own, but you're looking deeply to say, how do I keep this precept? What is right? So there's that. There's not talking about others' errors and faults. That could be a tough one. Again, it's like going toward it. You know, if we said, okay, I'm never going to do that again. Well, we could say that, but then we notice ourselves doing it. So then it's a practice. Here's another good one. Not elevating oneself and blaming others. And that's usually kind of related to the talking about others' errors and faults, right? Because they're doing the bad things. I'm not doing that, so I'm good. Not being stingy and not attaching to anything, even the truth. And actually, I like the way that we translate this precept for the ordination ceremony. We did the ordination ceremony a week ago yesterday, and the way that we state it there is not being stingy in the bestowal of the Dharma or material goods. And that's a little bit more of what that is about, not attaching to anything, even the truth. It's like anything. And then the truth, like the Dharma, we don't attach to that either. We don't keep that for ourselves. We just give it away. Not indulging in anger. And then the last one is not thinking ill of the three treasures. So the last one loops back to the three refuges, which were at the beginning of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So to practice these precepts, and we will be beginning in the fall a year-long program for people who want to take lay ordination, which is where you sew a raksu, a little, the small Buddhist robes that look like bibs, and you formally say, I am taking up the way of following these precepts, and I'm committed to this way of practice. So that's going to be a year-long project, which will look really deeply at all of these 16 bodhisattva precepts. So you'll, if you're, and even if you're not sure that you want to do the formal lay ordination or jukai, you can still take the classes and learn about the precepts. So that is coming up starting in the fall. But I just want to say something about how we practice these as a reminder to people who have been practicing and for people who are new to know. So there's a way in which we can look at these as literal, following them literally, like if we were following literally not giving or taking intoxicants. You know, for many people that would mean no alcohol, no drugs, right? So that's a literal interpretation. The literal interpretation can be impinging and rigid, but we really, in a way, we need to fully engage with that aspect of the precepts in order to, that's where we enter. We enter at the literal, and then what it means for us, and we struggle with it. Okay, not killing, does that mean being a vegetarian? I don't know. You know, struggle with it, engage it in the literal way. Don't just dismiss it. So we engage it in that concrete way. So that's the, maybe say the first level. It's not really like this, so it's not linear necessarily, but maybe we'd say that's usually the entry point, is this conventional or concrete or literal aspect. Another aspect of practicing the precepts that should be included is the absolute, so sometimes called the ultimate truth. Although it's not ultimate in opposed to the literal truth. It's ultimate in the sense of it's boundless, it's empty. It's not like the highest level. It's just, it's an aspect that needs to be included. Well, it is included, and so it's good for us to think about it. So here in this way, it's seeing the precepts, viewing the precepts in a way where there's no self and no other. And I guess that's all I'll say about that right now. And if you're going, huh? Then that's okay. Another level or aspect to working with the precepts is called the relative. And in some ways, it's not like the compromise between the literal and the absolute, but it's maybe a way in which They're both really upheld at the same time. So sometimes in the relative, we say this is compassion practice. This is where we're looking at right action depends on the circumstances, and where we're really seeing deeply the interconnectedness and how we are supporting others and others are supporting us. So I just wanted to, and this actually, there's like a whole, one of the classes that we'll be doing in the fall talks way more in detail about these three aspects. So I just wanted to touch on that now. So I want to come back to what does the flower ornament scripture, this sutra, say about the treasury of ethics? And of course, because it's famous for lists, it says, Bodhisattvas or enlightening beings have 10 ethics. You know, there's 10 kinds. And this is different than the 10 precepts. So this is like 10 ways of practicing the precepts in a way. And I'm not going to even say all 10. So if you want to know, you'll have to just take up the study of the flower ornament scripture yourself. One of the ethics in the treasury of ethics is the ethic of universal benefit. And this is practicing that bodhisattvas practice the precepts to benefit all beings. Then there's the ethic of non-dwelling. So here, bodhisattvas are not dwelling in the realm of desire. They're not dwelling in the realm of form. And they're not dwelling in the formless realm. And it says what this means is that they don't keep the precepts in the hopes of being born in a certain realm. So dwelling, is they're not staying in any one realm or hoping to be in any one realm. So sometimes, you know, we say, oh, I'm suffering here in this realm of form. You know, all the things that are going on in the world. I just want to be in the formless realm where everything is one and I don't have all these worries. And maybe if I practice the precepts really hard, then I'll get there. Or if I meditate really a lot, then I'll get there. But here it says no. It's not about practicing the precepts or doing any kind of practice in order to like get into heaven. So that's what the ethic of non-dwelling means. Another ethic in the treasury of ethics is the ethic of non-injury. And here it says, bodhisattvas do not harm beings on account of practicing the precepts. You could say, huh, that's interesting. Well, how would I harm beings on account of practicing the precepts? Well, that's where, you know, you can enter with that literal interpretation, but then you have to be careful as you go forward. For example, there's the precept of not speaking falsely. And, you know, usually the example for me that comes to mind right away is, okay, so I'm in Nazi Germany and I'm hiding Jews in my house, and the Nazis come to my door and say, are you hiding Jews in your house? Now, if I'm saying, well, I have to follow this precept of not speaking falsely, so I say yes, well, that would be harming beings, right? So I don't. I say something else. But it's important when we're doing that to really be looking at the big picture and looking deeply, and that we don't use that kind of relative stance with regard to the precepts as kind of an excuse for breaking the precepts, because that can happen too. So I'm not saying that everyone needs to be vegetarian. I don't have that view. But I have sometimes heard people say something like, well, when you're vegetarian, you're killing vegetables anyway. You know, you are. I mean, you're killing plants, right? You are. You're killing them. You pull them out of the earth and they're dead, and then you eat them. So then some people will say, so, you know, it doesn't really matter that I eat meat. And again, I'm not saying don't eat meat. That's for you to look deeply. But to do it like that is to kind of use this sort of excuse of the relative to justify the way you keep the precepts. So if you want to eat meat, then you have to look deeply and find something else. How is it that I can engage in the world in this way and be following the precepts? And there are some ways that people do. So some people like decide to, well, I'm going to try to buy my meat from animals that I know have been cared for humanely or have been raised in a way that is really protecting the earth. You know, so like that's one way. So anyway, there's different ways that you can look at this ethic of non-injury, but not use that relative interpretation as an excuse. Another treasury in the treasury of ethic is the ethic of non-defilement. And it says, this means not clinging to extreme or biased views. So you might have an extreme or biased view. And that's not a problem really to have it as long as you don't cling to it. So how do you do that? How do you proceed without clinging to it? So it's not that you just become passive and don't express it. Like that would sort of be a cop-out in a way. That would maybe be turning passive. So being upright in your view and yet not clinging to it. I don't have like a recipe for you to do that. It's an invitation to do it. And what I was thinking about when I was reading this is, so there are some extreme views that come up. Like some people here at Clouds have a view that capitalism is evil. So you might have heard that in some Dharma talks. So that's a kind of an extreme view. And some have a view that capitalism is good. And in a way that might be an extreme view too, although it's kind of more acceptable, so maybe it doesn't seem extreme. So I would say, how do we go forward in Sangha and express our views and not cling? That's the key. How do we do that? Well, contemplating interdependent origination, how everything arises in connection with everything else. Even that view that I have is arising in connection. Even that view that I have that seems conventional is arising in connection. So really looking at that. Really considering how there's a lot that we don't know. So even if we think that we're right, that's okay. We can think that and we can express that and we're trying to help beings, right? The people with the one view, capitalism is evil, and the people with the other view, capitalism is good, they're all trying to help beings. So knowing that, we can say, oh, there's a lot that I don't know. Can I listen to other people with a different view? Can I express my view and listen? And then sometimes it's like, okay, I'm drawing a line. That's okay too. But from the heart, not clinging to my view. And I mean, you can probably think of other, even more extreme views, right? Really difficult views that you want to really distance yourself from. And you don't want those views to be in the world. And that actually might be a good thing that you have that idea, that view not be in the world. How do you transform things? How do you transform that view being in the world or not? Well, if you're just clinging to your view and fighting about it, that's probably not going to accomplish as much as if you can really open and not cling and yet still go forward and stand upright. It's really hard to practice like that. But it is possible. And that's where we keep coming back to. We are practicing these precepts. We are practicing this way for the benefit of all beings. All right, we have another. I'll move on. I can tell it stirred up some stuff, but I kind of don't. I there's other stuff I want to talk about, so you can email me or talk to me afterwards. That capitalism word is like really a trigger. So, all right. Here's one that's easier though. The ethic of non-covetedness. How do you say that? Somebody help me out.
Covetousness.
Thank you. Non-covetousness. All right, what that means is do not display extraordinary signs to make a show of your virtue. So the coveting part, or the non-coveting part, is not to covet being virtuous by making a display of it. So not having a holier-than-thou kind of stance. And then kind of related to that, there's the ethic of impeccability. And the kind of main definition of impeccability is something like beyond sin or unable to sin, pure, like that. But here, in this sutra, impeccability is described as that bodhisattvas do not boast of themselves as upholding the precepts. And when they see someone breaking the precepts, they do not scorn or shame them. So that's the impeccability. So again, here, it doesn't mean that we don't speak out when we see some harm being done, and that when we have the EAR committee, the Ethics and Reconciliation Committee, and the grievance procedure here, it's a way to say, yes, do speak out if you see harm being done. But how can we consider how we can speak clearly and directly when we see harm being done without generating the belief or feeling that the perpetrator is worthless or deserving of hatred? How can we do that? That's the impeccability. Usually it seems like it's easy to just go to, oh yeah, they're bad, they did this thing. They're out of here. They're worthless. They deserve my hatred and everyone's hatred. But that's not the bodhisattva way. The bodhisattva way is to say, hey, is there a way that I can actually speak directly, call this what it is, call it out, say what's happening, say this isn't right, say this is harming beings, and yet do that in a way that does not shame or scorn or degrade the perpetrator? Really tough. Finally, there's the ethic of non-transgression, and that is described as keeping the 10 grave precepts. So it kind of loops back in a way, like, okay, it's keeping the 10 grave precepts. And I can't talk about all 10 precepts. I read them, but I want to talk about one, which is that one about not elevating oneself and blaming others. And the beginning part is speaking what I perceive to be the truth without guilt or blame. So there is the speaking the truth. That happens without elevating myself and blaming others. So that's very much related to the ethic of impeccability, the not scorning or shaming if we see someone breaking the precepts. When I've worked with this precept, I've also looked at how it doesn't only mean not elevate myself and blaming others, it also means not elevating others and blaming myself. So sometimes when we kind of forget that it means that too, we can sort of take blame that isn't really ours and then not speak out against harm being done. So We want to be careful that we're actually practicing this precept in a wholesome way. When we see someone doing something or saying something that's harmful, it's our responsibility to call it out. Otherwise, we're complicit in continuing the harm. So for a lot of us, we might want to avoid conflict if we can. We might want to turn away if we can, but that's not our practice. Our practice is to invite ourselves to face the difficult issues, face our discomfort, be present, breathe, and act. And Zazen helps us to do this, right? Practicing Zazen, we sit down, we're present. We invite ourselves to be present with whatever's coming up. Sometimes difficult things come up, and we invite ourselves to not turn away. And so then taking this from the personal to the Sangha level, the EAR committee here is a group that is helping us to do that, to be present. So in Sangha, there's a few things you can do if there's difficult issues that arise. You can just address someone directly, either with a witness or just, you know, on your own. Perhaps using the beginning anew process, which I don't have time to go into, but if anyone's interested, we should really have that on our website if we don't. That's from Thich Nhat Hanh. It's a beautiful way of engaging with someone with a difficult conversation. You can ask teachers for help. You can use the precepts as guidelines. And you can consult the EAR committee. So this is the Ethics and Reconciliation Committee. It can be a clearinghouse for concerns and complaints. And we'll have a ceremony that's going to be honoring. We have 6 new people coming on to the EAR committee, and there's other people who have served for a while who are leaving. And so we have a ceremony that will honor that transition just right after the talk in a few minutes. But I just want to make sure that, and that's partly why I handed out the brochures, that everyone knows that we have this group. So, you know, sometimes people think of it as like, okay, this is a grievance, if I have a grievance. But maybe you have something that's just, I wonder about this. This is kind of, it seems troubling to me, or I question about it. And for whatever reason you feel like, don't feel comfortable talking with one of the teachers about it, then the EAR committee is there for you. And you can just email ear@cloudsandwater.org, or you can, their names are posted on the bulletin board if you wanted to talk to someone individually. And even if you're not sure if your concern is related to breaking a precept, you can still ask the EAR committee. They can help you. And we're always, I don't know if I want to say happy. I feel maybe happy is the right word. I feel glad when people do come forward, you know, with an issue, because I would much rather that people come forward than not. That's how our Sangha stays healthy. And now I can see I'm not going to have time to talk about the treasury of shame. I'll say one thing about it, though, just so you know, that I think we misunderstand the treasury of shame because a lot of times we take on shame that's not ours. So something's done to us, like maybe we're, maybe we're abused as a child or neglected, or maybe we've been sexually assaulted or something, and then we take on shame about it. And that's not our shame. We didn't do anything wrong. So a lot of times people, and then we get stuck in that shame. And that's not the treasury of shame. The treasury of shame is really the thing about the painful feelings that arise as a result of something I did wrong. I did something wrong, and then painful feelings arise. And it's kind of related to also thinking that how I've harmed others, or if others could see me, this would not be, I would not feel proud of what I'm doing. So in the sutra, it says, that the treasury of shame is bodhisattvas consider that the Buddhas of the past, present, and future see me. So when you're doing something. And one thing that I do as a practice is a lot of times when I'm here, the Sangha is always seeing me. So I have the treasury of shame, like helping to uphold me all the time. But when I'm at home or elsewhere, I don't. But sometimes I think, well, what if the Sangha could see me doing this? Would I be ashamed? And if the answer is yes, then it's like, then I don't do it. So that's the treasury of shame. It's like using that to really do what we know to be right and that to be wholesome. And then I'll just say real quickly, the treasury of conscience. It's kind of related to the treasury of shame. Enlightening beings are ashamed of past afflictions of greed, anger, folly, etc., and they resolve that they should not act this way anymore. So in other words, they use the wholesome, painful emotion that arises from seeing the ways they've caused harm in the past in order to set a deep intention to refrain from causing harm in the future. And I really see the ear committee as part of the conscience of the community. I mean, they're not only the, we all have to be that, but they're part of the helping us to have this intention to not do harm in the future, to actually look at what we've done and then move forward with not doing harm in a wholesome way. So that's all she wrote for now. Thank you so much for listening, and we have so many things that there's not time for a discussion, but as I said, if you want to find me afterwards or email me a question, I'd be happy to receive that. So thank you so much.
Closing chant is in your program. May your intention equally penetrate every being in place with the true merit of Buddha's way.